Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record program number 578, titled Darkness at Sunrise, The Interdiction of Operation Safe Haven. This has been recorded on November 26th of the year 2006. As is the case with many of the programs, your understanding of For the Record 578 will be greatly enhanced if you use the many materials available on the Spitfire website and linked websites. More about that at the end of the program. Now, we have been focusing on the neutralization, the interdiction of Operation Safe Haven. That was the U.S. Treasury Department-based intelligence operation that was undertaken during the closing months of World War II in a vain attempt to interdict the Nazi flight capital program, which was to spawn the Bormann Capital Network, about which I speak so often. In Side 1, we took a look at how people who were serving with the U.S. Intelligence Command and who also were Wall Street potentates, people who had worked as industrialist financiers and lawyers on Wall Street and in the highest echelons of American and British business, finance, and national security operations, undertook to interdict Operation Safe Haven. Specifically, we took a look at how people like Alan Dulles, people like William Donovan, people like William Stevenson, Edward Stettinius, and Frank Wisner, all of whom had involvement with the intelligence community and with the exception of Stettinius that I'm aware of, and who also, including Stettinius, were very much involved with the highest echelons of American and British industry and finance. The World Commerce Corporation was a vehicle for effecting a Nazi money go-round for Nazi monies fleeing Europe under Operation Adlerflug and then arriving in Latin America with the assistance of the Vatican Bank. They were then repatriated back to Germany courtesy of the World Commerce Corporation, thus frustrating Operation Safe Haven. What we're going to take a look at in Side 2 is something called Operation Sunrise. This was a separate negotiation undertaken by Alan Dulles to effect the surrender of all Nazi forces in northern Italy. The chief counterplayer with Alan Dulles was SS General Karl Wolff, Himmler's personal adjutant, a war criminal of the First Order, and the man who was basically in charge of all Nazi forces in Italy. Note that it was the negotiations under Operation Sunrise which helped to facilitate the Vatican's collaboration with the Nazis and with the Dulles milieu in helping to neutralize Operation Safe Haven. Now remember, at this point in time, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was still alive, was planning on having the German industrialists and financiers implicate their American and British counterparts, and some of the most powerful names in American finance and industry would have been in the defendant's dock at Nuremberg, including Alan and John Foster Dulles. It was not to be. What we're going to take a look at is Operation Sunrise, in which Alan Dulles and Karl Wolff and others, chiefly Wolff aide Eugen Dohlmann, a key SS man and Nazi spy, and on the American side, General Lyman Lemnitzer, who was to go on to do big things in the post-war years. We're going to take a look at this separate piece as they were working it out. Although initially the Soviets approved of the Dulles-Wolff negotiations in Italy, as we're going to see, the negotiations which had been undertaken with the initiative of the Vatican and Cardinal Schuster were actually against the spirit of the Yalta Agreement. Specifically, what Dulles and Wolff were working out was a separate negotiation which would have permitted American and British forces to flood in on the Western Front in violation of the accords between Stalin and Roosevelt. Now, it was right in the middle of the Sunrise negotiations that Franklin Delano Roosevelt died. Specifically, he died on a day that the Nazi astrologers viewed as propitious for the Nazi cause. Roosevelt also died under very strange circumstances. He was having his picture painted by a couple of white Russians, including a woman named Elizabeth Shumatov. He then keeled over right in the middle of the sitting. The two white Russians drove lickety-split through a driving driving rainstorm in rural Georgia, didn't even stick around to inquire about Roosevelt's well-being and heard that he had died on the radio. Eventually, Roosevelt, as revealed in a 1979 San Francisco Chronicle article, Roosevelt's medical records disappeared from Bethesda Naval Hospital. And it was right in the middle of the Sunrise negotiations that FDR died. Bear in mind, he was planning on putting Allen Dulles and others into the defendant's docket. Nuremberg, basically what Loftus and Ahrens term some of the pirates of Wall Street, would have wound up in the defendant's docket. Nuremberg. However, Operation Sunrise turned out to be anything but that. It actually turned out to be the onset of darkness, not the onset of light. For our discussion of Operation Sunrise and how it also helped to frustrate Operation Safe Haven, we're going to turn to the book The Splendid Blonde Beast, subtitled Money, Law, and Genocide in the 20th Century. This book was authored by Christopher Simpson. It's published in softcover by the Common Courage Press, copyright 1995 by Christopher Simpson. Of Allen Dulles and his negotiations with Carl Wolff and Operation Sunrise, Simpson writes, "When Dulles opened contacts with Wolff in early 1945, the British military command in Italy notified the Soviets that new peace negotiations had begun for a rapid German surrender of northern Italy. The Soviets replied that they were glad to hear this. All that was required under standing Allied agreements on negotiations with the enemy was for a handful of senior Soviet military representatives to monitor the progress of the talks. Now, as we will see, this permission was not granted, and it was vetoed by then U.S. Ambassador to Moscow, Averell Harriman, who was the partners with the Bush family in the Union Banking Corporation and other joint American-German enterprises that were to help to finance the Nazi war machine. And as we're going to see, Averell Harriman put the whammy on permitting Soviets to monitor the Sunrise negotiations, thereby helping to deepen the already growing divide between the U.S. and the Soviets before the guns fell silent in World War II. Of the Soviet request to monitor the Dulles-Wolff-Sunrise negotiations, Christopher Simpson writes, "The U.S. ambassador to Moscow, Averell Harriman, vetoed that. Inviting the Soviets to the negotiations would make the Germans nervous, he contended, and would only encourage the Soviets to insist on participation in other upcoming decisions about the former Axis territories already held by U.S. and British troops. His was one of the most important voices on U.S.-Soviet relations, and his opinion carried the day." Roosevelt and Stalin exchanged increasingly bitter notes as the negotiations continued in Switzerland among Dulles, the SS representatives, and a crew of senior U.S. military officers that included, and note this first name, Major General Lyman Lemnitzer and General Hoyt Vandenberg. A few weeks after the talks began, Soviet Foreign Minister Molotov sent a note to Harriman in Moscow expressing complete surprise, unquote, that Soviet representatives were still barred from the talks. He said that the situation was inexplicable in terms of the relations of alliance, unquote, between the U.S. and USSR. If the U.S. refused to permit Soviet representatives to participate, Molotov contended, the talks had to be abandoned. Roosevelt wrote directly to Stalin a few days later. "The USSR misunderstood what was taking place," he insisted. "The talks in Italy were basically a local matter, comparable to that in which the Baltic coast cities of Königsberg and Danzig had earlier surrendered to the Soviets." Roosevelt seemed to approve Soviet participation in the talks. "I will be pleased to have at any discussion of the details of surrender the benefit of the experience and advice of any of your officers who can be present," unquote. But Roosevelt insisted that the talks in Switzerland were an investigation, unquote, of a local German commander's surrender offer, not a negotiation, unquote. Time was of the essence, Roosevelt continued, and the U.S. representatives could not be faulted for being eager to accept the surrender of the German troops they were facing on the battlefield. Stalin escalated the argument, and as we can see here, in many ways, this is the genesis of the modern Cold War. His foreign minister, Molotov, suddenly had new commitments in Moscow and would not attend the founding of Roosevelt's most cherished post-war project, the United Nations Organization. This was a calculated slight, and both sides knew it. In a new note to FDR, Stalin replied that he was, quote, "all for profiting from cases of disintegration in the German armies," unquote. But in this case, the Germans were using the talks to maneuver, unquote, and to transfer troops from Italy to the Eastern Front. Roosevelt replied that Soviet actions in Poland and Romania had not lived up to the commitments made at the Yalta Conference less than 2 months previously. U.S.-Soviet relations had moved rapidly to a, quote, atmosphere of regrettable apprehension and mistrust, unquote, owing to the confrontation over Dulles' talks with the SS, Roosevelt commented, and again insisted to Stalin that the talks were for, quote, the single purpose of arranging contact with competent German military officers and not for negotiations of any kind, unquote. Meanwhile, FDR cabled Dulles in Switzerland and ordered him to present the SS representatives with a take-it-or-leave-it offer of an unconditional surrender. No further negotiation would be permitted, President Roosevelt said. Stalin seemed to know many of the details of the Dulles-SS talks even before Roosevelt did. When FDR tried to soothe Stalin with a declaration that the Swiss talks were without political significance, Stalin shot back that, quote, apparently you are not fully informed, unquote. Stalin's military intelligence agents in Switzerland were, quote, sure that negotiations did take place and that they ended in an agreement with the Germans, whereby the German commander on the Western Front, Marshal Kesselring, is to open the front to the Anglo-American troops and let them move east, while the British and Americans had promised an exchange to ease the armistice terms for the Germans. I think my colleagues are not very far from the truth, unquote, Stalin continued. If this perception was wrong, he asked, why were his men still being excluded from the talks? So, again, the Dulles-Wolf negotiations under Sunrise were helping to exacerbate the divide between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, and it is right in this time period that FDR died under the circumstances that I explained earlier. Bear in mind that FDR was going to place Alan Dulles and others of the American financial and industrial elite in the defendant's dock at Nuremberg, and that would have included the grandfather and great-grandfather of the current seated president of the United States. Continuing with Christopher Simpson's account of the Sunrise negotiations, Stalin may have overstated his case, but he was not far off. These were, in fact, exactly the terms that Cardinal Schuster had proposed and that Alan Dulles had discussed with Wolfe. No final deal had been struck, though, and by early April, both sides in Switzerland were once again seeking guidance from their representative home offices. By then, though, the German front had begun to collapse throughout Europe. The Red Army was at the gates of Berlin, and Dulles' grand plan to take Central Europe by way of Trieste had failed. The Bern incident, as Roosevelt described it in a last letter to Stalin written only hours before his death, quote, now appears to have faded into the past without having accomplished any useful purpose, unquote. The talks had not been successful from either Alan Dulles' or SS General Wolfe's points of view, largely because Roosevelt had ruled out any formal agreement with the Germans other than unconditional surrender. But FDR's ban on a formal agreement did not preclude Dulles from making more limited gentlemen's agreements, unquote, with his SS counterparts for concessions that he saw as advantageous to the OSS or to U.S. geopolitical strategy. The SS delegation, the Swiss intelligence envoys who were serving as go-betweens, and the Soviet agents secretly monitoring the talks each came away from the talks convinced that Dulles had agreed to provide protection and assistance to General Wolfe and his SS entourage in exchange for a quick surrender of German troops in Italy, although Dulles would deny this later. Wolfe's ultimately empty promises of a dramatic German surrender that would advance U.S. and British forces far to the east captivated Dulles and his OSS colleagues in Switzerland. Dulles intervened on a half dozen occasions in an effort to keep the Operation Sunrise negotiations on track, even after the joint U.S.-British military command in Italy ordered him to desist. By the last week of April, senior U.S. and British military commanders in Italy concluded that the Sunrise Project was little more than a desperate SS effort to fracture Allied unity and told Dulles to cut off all contacts with Wolfe and his emissaries. Nevertheless, Dulles' top aide, Gero von Gevernitz, kept the negotiations open and acted with Dulles' tacit cooperations to rescue Wolfe from Italian partisans. The U.S.-British Combined Chiefs of Staff are known to have opened an investigation into Dulles' alleged dereliction of duty and refusal to obey orders in connection with the Wolfe rescue, but the records of this inquiry have disappeared from OSS and military files and have yet to be rediscovered. The unofficial truce in Italy that took hold as the negotiations went on probably saved lives, if only because ground combat is so brutal that even a few hours' respite can reduce casualties. But Roosevelt's conclusion that the negotiations failed to achieve a genuine German surrender in Italy is accurate. As a practical matter, Operation Sunrise contributed considerably more to souring U.S.-Soviet relations and to enhancing Allen Dulles' carefully cultivated reputation as a spy master than it ever did to winning the war in Europe. Now we're going to take a look at how Operation Sunrise ultimately led to some collaboration in the post-war period between people like Allen Dulles and Carl Wolff and Lyman Lemnitzer, and how they became something of a community of interests and literally scratched each other's backs. Skipping ahead, in Simpson's The Splendid Blonde Beast, the more sophisticated Axis defendants soon learned how to make the most of the divisions among the Allies. The post-war careers of the SS men who had negotiated with Allen Dulles during Operation Sunrise provide an example of how symbiotic relationships evolved among the victors and the vanquished during the first years after the war. The Dulles case is interesting not only because it was typical of thousands of less prominent instances, but also because of the symmetry in Dulles' behavior in the wake of two different genocides, the Armenian Genocide and the Nazi Holocaust, more than two decades apart. Skipping down. Though Dulles was later to deny it, he extended de facto protection to Carl Wolff and at least two of his assistants, Eugen Dolman and Eugen Venner, both of whom were later indicted by Italian authorities for their roles in massacres of Italian partisans and the deportation of Italian Jews to Auschwitz. Circumstantial evidence links Dulles to the escape of another of Wolff's assistants, Walter Wauff, whose rise through SS ranks had been helped by his use of gas trucks to murder thousands of Jewish women and children on the Eastern Front. Allied war crimes investigators identified Wolff almost immediately as one of the most powerful members of the Nazi inner circle to survive the war. The French and Soviet governments favored prosecuting Wolff before the First International Tribunal at Nuremberg, an honor of sorts, as this trial was reserved for the highest-ranking Nazi criminals in custody. Had Wolff been tried there, he almost certainly would have been hung. But he wasn't, and we're going to take a look at what happened. Skipping down again. In late 1949, the British brought Carl Wolff before a denazification board, not an Allied court, in Hamburg, a move that might be fairly compared to charging the SS leader with traffic violations. Wolff's Sunrise colleagues turned out in force for the denazification, unquote. Allen Dulles, General Lyman Lemnitzer, and General Terence Airy each submitted an affidavit on Wolff's behalf to the German panel. Dulles' senior aide, Gero von Gevernitz, testified in person as a defense witness. The board deliberated briefly, determined that the Carl Wolff in the dock was in fact the well-known Nazi and SS leader, then went on to conclude that the time Wolff had served in Allied internment since the war had been punishment enough. Carl Wolff was free to go. And still more about the post-war career of Allen Dulles and Carl Wolff. There was a common pattern in the U.S. treatment of SS men involved in the Operation Sunrise negotiations. It began with early capture by U.S. forces, followed by transport of the suspect to some form of privileged custody, such as a hospital or a sanitarium, or into British custody. At least some of these transfers, such as Dolman and Venner's move to Germany, were arranged by U.S. military and State Department officials specifically to help the former SS men escape trial in an Allied country. The chain of documentary evidence concerning Dulles' role in the Wolff case is circumstantial but strong, and it indicates that Dulles joined with senior U.S. and British officials in securing an amnesty for the highest-ranking Nazi criminal to escape the war. And what we're going to take a look at is one of the things that Carl Wolff did in the post-war period. We're going to take a look now at the work of a guy named John Frenchy Grombach, last name G-R-O-M-B-A-C-H. He'd been a military intelligence officer in World War II, and then in the post-war period occupied a sort of mid-turf between official government and private functions and began recruiting former SS men and Nazi collaborators to provide intelligence not only to official American government bodies such as the CIA, for whom he officially worked, but also to allied private networks as well. One of the most important informants for John Frenchy Grombach was none other than SS General Karl Wolff. Remember that Alan Dulles and General Lyman Lemnitzer, who had negotiated on the American side with Karl Wolff for the Sunrise negotiations, submitted affidavits on Wolff's behalf. What we're going to look at now is how Karl Wolff, through John Frenchy Grombach, provided intelligence to, among others, Senator Joe McCarthy in his anti-communist witch hunts. And as we will see, among the people that were tarred with the anti-communist brush, not only by Joe McCarthy but others, in the immediate post-World War II period, were Morgenthau's aides in the Treasury Department, Harry Dexter White, and Lachlan Curry, both involved with attempting to interdict Operation Safe Haven. Which was eventually interdicted. Of John Frenchy Grombach, his work for both the CIA and private networks allied with Joe McCarthy, and his use of Karl Wolff, we read, turning now to the book Blowback, also authored by Christopher Simpson, published in hard and soft cover by Macmillan, and also by Weidenfeld and Nicholson. Of John Frenchy Grombach and his work with both Karl Wolff and his networks, and his work, that is to say, Grombach's work with Wolff on behalf of both CIA and Joe McCarthy, we read from Blowback. One of Grombach's most important assets, according to U.S. Naval Intelligence records obtained under the Freedom of Information Act, was SS General Karl Wolff, a major war criminal who had gone into the arms trade in Europe after the war. Skipping down. Grombach worked simultaneously under contract to the Department of State and the CIA. The ex-military intelligence man succeeded in creating, quote, one of the most unusual organizations in the history of the federal government, unquote, according to CIA Inspector General Lyman Kirkpatrick. Again, quoting, it was developed completely outside of the normal governmental structure, but it used all of the normal cover and communications facilities normally operated by intelligence organizations, and yet never was under any control from Washington, unquote. By the early 1950s, the U.S. government was bankrolling Grombach's underground activities at more than $1 million annually, Kirkpatrick has said. And that was a lot more money, by the way, $1 million a year in the early 50s than it is today. Speaking of Grombach, his organization stood ready, he said, to purge the State Department and the CIA of communist dupes, homosexuals, and liberals of all stripes. High on the list of his targets were the men who had articulated and implemented Truman's containment strategy versus communism, George Kennan, Charles Thayer, Charles Bowen, and their allies at State and the CIA. In Grombach's eyes, these officials were like his old nemesis Colonel McCormick, too soft on communism in the USSR, too favorable to liberal elements in the CIA, too closely tied to the elitist Eastern establishment that had been running the State Department for generations. Grombach banked on his close connections with Senators Joseph McCarthy, William Jenner, and other members of the extreme Republican right to propel him to national power. He believed that the McCarthyite right was on its way to the White House, and he intended to be there when it arrived. Grombach's outfit effectively became the Foreign Espionage Agency for the far right, often serving as the overseas complement of McCarthy's generally warm relations with J. Edgar Hoover's FBI at home, skipping down. This was the American agent's specialty, his true passion. Political dirt, sexual dirt, any kind of compromising information at all. He got into a lot of garbage pails, as Kirkpatrick puts it, and issued dirty linen reports on Americans, unquote. Grombach collected scandal, cataloged it, and used it carefully, just as he had done during the earlier McCormick investigation. He leaked smears to his political allies in Congress and the press when it suited his purposes to do so. Grombach and congressional internal security investigators bartered these dossiers with one another, almost as though the boys were trading baseball cards. Grombach leaked these dirty linen files to Senator McCarthy, according to both Kirkpatrick and Yilitalo. And that is some of the dirt that he was basically spreading. Now, some of the people who were on the receiving end of Grombach's dirty linen reports, now bear in mind that Grombach's dirty linen reports were generated with the assistance of, among others, a network of SS men run by Karl Wolff, who'd been negotiating with Lemnitzer and Alan Dulles on the other side of the Sunrise negotiations. And one of the people who basically was tarred by these investigations, these Dirty Linen reports, is discussed in the book The Nightmare Decade, The Life and Times of Senator Joe McCarthy by Fred J. Cook. Talking about how unsubstantial McCarthy's charges were, that out of a total of 2.5 million federal employees, only some 75 could even be accused of communist activities. Of this minuscule number, two, Harold Ware and Harry Dexter White, had died. Of the remainder, just two, Alger Hiss and Wilming Remington, had been tried and convicted on perjury charges. Both of these cases had been developed in 1948 before McCarthy exhibited any awareness of the communist menace, and both have remained infinitely suspect prosecutions. So note that Harry Dexter White, aide to Morgenthau, key participant in the Safe Haven operation, was one of the people tarred by the McCarthy investigations, and note that he died during the course of his ordeal at the hands of McCarthy. And among the others who were tarred by the anti-communist witch hunts and by McCarthy were Lachlan Curry. And it was simply the fact that Owen Lattimore, a State Department official, had managed correspondence for Lachlan Curry was seen as enough of proof by McCarthy of Owen Lattimore's communist affiliations. Again, from Fred Cook's The Nightmare Decade. Speaking of the, quote, proof against Owen Lattimore, that in 1942 he was requested to and did take care of the correspondence of Lachlan Curry while Curry was away on a trip. And it was his association with Lachlan Curry that to McCarthy was seen as proof of Owen Lattimore's communist sympathies. Later, some purported intercepts of Soviet intelligence alleged that Lachlan Curry was in fact a Soviet agent. I take that stuff with a grain of salt. While it's possible it's true, it's against the background of a massive attempt at rewriting the history of the Treasury Department, Operation Safe Haven, and people associated with Henry Morgenthau. And among the people whose official history has been rewritten is the history of former Treasury Secretary Morgenthau. Reading now to conclude the broadcast from J. Edgar Hoover, The Man and His Secrets by Kurt Gentry. Hoover was not only determined to manipulate the news, deciding what the public should or should not know, but he also altered history in the process, exacting revenge against one of his most hated enemies, that Jew in the Treasury, unquote, Henry Morgenthau, Jr. During his nearly dozen years as Secretary of the Treasury, Morgenthau kept a daily diary which included not only his own recollections of events, but also verbatim transcriptions of his meetings and telephone calls. Moreover, as a member of FDR's inner cabinet, he was privy to the behind-the-scenes activities of most of the rest of the government. According to the historian Jason Berger, it would be difficult to understate the importance of the Morgenthau diaries to scholars of the New Deal era. As, quote, the only source of daily happenings in Washington, Berger notes, they are a researcher's dream. On leaving office, Morgenthau had given his papers to the National Archives for safekeeping until such time as he decided to make them public. And learning in 1951 that Morgenthau was discussing publication of the diaries, Hoover struck. It was a very covert operation, a senior agent who headed the raiding party has recalled. Damn covert. There were five of us, and we were all sworn to absolute secrecy. We even left the Washington field office by various devious routes, and we'd go in and out of the way room at the National Archives at different times, so no one would know what five agents were in that room, and we were the only ones who had a key. The full description of this operation will be in the description for the Record 578. Note that according to the agents who disclosed this to Kurt Gentry, FDR's personal records had been altered in the same fashion, pointing out that the rewriting of history and the introduction of Operation Safe Haven continued decades into the post-World War II period. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record 578, Darkness at Sunrise, the interdiction of Operation Safe Haven, being recorded on November 26th of the year 2006. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.